This talk is about providing reliable and accurate timing in virtualized systems. Now, as the title of the talk suggests, there's a kind of antagonism between virtualization on the one hand and absolute real time on the other, which is here clearly tied to physics. And hopefully I'll be able to show in this talk how those two can be married together in an appropriate way. And before anyone asks, yes, I will be assuming Newtonian space-time in this talk to make my life easy. I'd like to acknowledge the Australian Research Council and Google Research Award for supporting this work. So, clock synchronization, you know, who cares about that? Our point of view is that this is a fundamental infrastructure service that needs to be provided to a higher quality as possible to support, you know, a whole range of future and current applications. It's true that many applications don't care, and other applications care, but only care to some granularity, which is perhaps not very fine, like 1 second. But there are plenty of other applications which do care very much. Coming from my own field of network measurement and monitoring, some of the key data that you want to analyze is the raw timestamps of packet arrivals and departures. That's the raw data, and there's no level of accuracy that is too much for you. Another good example is distributed gaming. It's kind of important to know that you're dead, so you don't go ahead and produce any collateral damage inappropriately. But more generally, distributed scheduling, which at the moment we believe there's a feeling out there that the timing is not reliable, so you don't even think of using it, and instead you'll be using some kind of message passing. Whereas if the opposite were true, that could open up new opportunities and greater performance. The status quo under Zen of timekeeping is based on the status quo of timekeeping in the internet as a whole and on all the computers that you're looking at right now, when you should be listening to my talk. It's based on the NTP system, the network time protocol, the servers out there, the protocol itself, and the NTPD daemon that does the synchronization. Adding virtualization to that amplifies the flaws of NTPD, and I'll go into that. And crucially, when it comes to the live migration of a VM machine, it fails rather miserably. So what we'll be providing is a new architecture to solve those problems. It's based on a project that I've been running at the University of Melbourne for quite a few years called the RadCop project. That's robust, absolute, and difference clock, which provides accurate and robust timing across the internet. And it just turns out that it's a very good match for the kind of architecture that can solve these problems, in particular providing seamless migration. So let me reveal to you immediately the key idea. It's very simple. Each physical host will, in fact, have just a single clock that's tied to the hardware of that host, and it's never going to migrate. So, in fact, there is no migration problem. When a virtual host migrates from one physical host, when a virtual machine migrates from a physical host to another, in fact, only a stateless clock reading function will migrate, so it doesn't get confused because it doesn't carry any state baggage with it. So this is, in fact, the concept of a dependent clock. It's not new, and we didn't come up with it. But making this actually work involves, you know, architecture of the clock itself, which is compatible, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. I need some quick background. We're talking about, in the context of parallel virtualization of Zen, so we have a hypervisor, which is a kind of a minimal kernel managing physical resources. We're talking about paravirtualization, which is where the guest operating systems are, in fact, aware that they're virtualized, they're aware of the hypervisor, and they can call upon these hypercalls to gain reasonably direct access to some physical resources. The fully virtualized case, where the guest operating system is unaware that it's living in a virtual world, is a bit more complicated, and we don't treat that in our work. So we're focusing on Zen because, you know, Zen is quite mature and it was out there, but the concepts I'll be talking about really are extremely general, and there's no reason why the same approach can't be applied to other virtual incarnations. The key thing we need to remember here is that under Zen, paravirtualized Zen, we have domain zero, which is just a single privileged guest operating system, and all the other guest operating systems, which are domain U, which have to mediate through domain zero to get for certain resources. Now, a key thing about that physical connection to real time is the physical thing is oscillators that actually live in the hardware, and you gain access to their ticks through counters, through hardware counters. Some important examples are HPET, ACPI, and TSC. These counters have a nominal fixed frequency, but it is not fixed. It's just a nominal rough number. These counters are drifting along, in particular with temperature. The operating system can also impact on their behavior. In particular, the latency to access them will depend on various features in the operating system, and I'll talk about more about that later. An important example is the TSC, which in x86 architectures counts ticks of the CPU since boot time. If you've got it, it's fantastic. It's very high resolution, of course, very fast access, but we need to be careful that on older architectures, it may be unreliable, in particular because of power management, which could be changing frequencies and so on. HPET, the high precision event timer, doesn't suffer from those kinds of disadvantages, but it's got high latency because it's read over a bus and, of course, lower resolution. In the particular context of Zen, we have a new counter, which is part of the Zen project. It's a kind of a hybrid of software and hardware, and its aim was to combine the reliability of HPET with the fast access of TSC. It's a nominally one gigahertz 64-bit counter. We spend a certain amount of quite a bit of time in the paper really putting this under the microscope, analyzing its latency performance and comparing it to HPET. Unfortunately, I haven't got time to go into that, but a quick summary of what we found is that this counter actually works very well. It's got low latency, high stability. It's a perfectly good counter for use. But on the other hand, it has got this relatively complicated interpolation mechanism. At the end of the day, once you include the overheads of that, it's not that much better than HPET, which is much simpler. And in the future, with TSC becoming reliable again, the need for such a mechanism is questionable. But I will be presenting results for clocks using Zen Clock Source, and NTPD, in fact, on Zen, uses NTP Clock Source as its underlying counter. And it's already available to all of the guest operating systems. So one, the things we need to know about clocks, several key points. So the first one is there's a complete... very clear distinction between timekeeping and time stamping. So you may have an absolutely perfect clock, but of course if you can't read the clock when you need to, then the timestamps are still problematic. So it's very important to keep those separate. A distinction which is very important for us here is that the difference between a raw timestamp, and what I mean by that is reading the raw counter. When you read the hardware counter, we call that a raw timestamp, compared to reading the final software clock, which is, of course, a totally different beast. That software clock is an output of an algorithm which takes in multiple inputs. It's complicated, very different from just reading the raw counter or raw scaled counter. But as I said before, scaled counters certainly aren't good by themselves. They drift. And the whole purpose of the clock synchronization algorithm is to be able to correct for that drift. And the way that it's done at low cost is to refer to the expert somewhere else out there in the network. And here's a little diagram showing what happens. We'll send a packet from a host to a time server that we trust, and then the packet comes back. We end up with four timestamps, two in the host and two at the server, and that's the raw data that the algorithm uses to synchronize the local clock. Two key problems in clock synchronization. One is dealing with delay variability. We have highly variable delays in the internet, also quite considerable and highly variable delays in the host itself. They effectively distort timestamps. The whole purpose of the clock algorithm is to be able to somehow see through that to filter it out successfully. The other problem, which is completely orthogonal to that and which no algorithm can alter, is the problem of path symmetry, asymmetry. There's a fundamental ambiguity between a constant error that a clock may have and that same constant divided by two of added to a path asymmetry. Now, algorithms cannot do that. I cannot get around this problem. In practice, what they typically do is assume perfect symmetry in order to provide a unique value, a new timestamp when you want to read the clock. So there are subtleties in path asymmetry, which I haven't got time to go into, but it's important to mention it because there are a couple of things that will come up, and I'll refer to that again. So we're talking about two synchronization algorithms, the NTPD system, which is the status quo. Key thing about this is that it's feedback-based. And the most important thing that I mean by that is that when timestamps are made, those timestamps are already system clock timestamps right from the beginning. Even when you're timestamping the packets which are coming from the server, the timestamps are in fact final clock reads. Okay. There are also other issues. There's also the fact that the NTPD daemon is not the only seat of intelligence for the system. There's also code in the system clock, kernel code, which interacts with NTPD. So it's a kind of a two-headed system with feedback between them, which makes it more complicated and more prone to instability. The RagClock project is based in a very different. It's based, first of all, on raw timestamps. We call it feed-forward-based because you correct a clock, an estimate of clock error in post-processing, so to speak, when the clock is read, rather than feeding in your current perceptions of time right in from the beginning. And so you gain this greater modularity and a reduction in the... Basically, we cut out the possibility of entering some kind of unstable mode. Experimental methodology that I'll be using to present the results, I'll be showing you lots of graphs, and they all come from this setup here. So on the left, we have our host running Xen, multiple operating systems, and with multiple clocks inside them. On the right-hand side, we have our Stratum 1 time servers. They'll be on the LAN in this case. We have a high-quality GPS on the roof feeding an atomic clock, which then in turn feeds into a PC running a Stratum 1 NTP server. And in the middle, we have this independent timestamping validation setup. We have a purpose-built DAG card, which is also fed by the atomic clock pulse per second, giving us some accurate timestamping of packets as they pass by this passive tap in the middle there. So that when the clocks in the host talk to the... they talk across the LAN here to the server, those packets are whizzing back and forth so the clocks can synchronize. But the data that I'll be showing you comes not from those packets, but from a stream of UDP packets, which are labeled there in the lighter color, going backwards and forwards from a separate box. They're also independently timestamped in the middle, and they act as just a set of timestamping opportunities whereby we can then compare all the different clocks in the system, including our external validation clocks. Okay, so now the talk can really start. Okay, we've got some annoying background stuff out of the way. So what's the problem? Okay, NTP is out there now for a long time, and it can perform well if everything is going right. So here's an example of that. Where we have everything is wonderful, lightly loaded LAN, Stratum 1 is on the LAN. We have a poll period, that's the time interval in between the exchange of timestamps to the server and back, of 16 seconds, which is fairly respectable, and we get good results here. You know, we've got an error here of 50 microseconds and an interquartile range for that of only about 10 microseconds. This is good. Okay. But if we change configurations a bit, that can change. So in this case, we still have the same great server. It's still on the LAN. We just changed a couple of things. We still have no load, but we gave it access to multiple servers, and we allowed it to change its own polling period rather than fixing it to a constant. And this is, in fact, what is recommended out of the box. This is what you're supposed to do for NTPD. And as a result, it loses that lock, and the feedback system becomes unstable. So starting from the left, this is one continuous experiment you're looking at. Starting on the left, we have the lock with just a single server, same configuration as before. Then we change a parameter, and we see... it loses lock, and we start getting millisecond-level errors. Then we switch back to the original configuration. It settles down. Then we give it access to three servers instead of one, and so on. We see that when we make these apparently innocent changes of configuration, size of the error can jump quite dramatically. And this is the real problem with NTPD. You never really know when it's going to perform well and when it doesn't, so it's not reliable. So you can't rely on it. This is the whole problem. So that was in a normal context, a normal host, unvirtualized. Now what about the Xen context? I want to try and convince you that NTPD is really just totally unsuitable for virtualization in particular. So three examples, starting with a dependent NTPD clock. A dependent clock, it's not our terminology. What that means is that there will only be a single clock on domain 0, and it will be the same clock, just the one clock for the whole system, and other guest operating systems will somehow read that clock. Great idea, and that's what we do too. So let's have a look at that. So here we are. Now the solution that we found that was out there using this dependent clock concept, domain 0 made timestamps available periodically by altering a variable in the hypervisor, which all the other guests could access. And in between those updates, the guest would use Zen clock source counter to interpolate, basically. And we see the results here are really bad. We get this horrible sawtooth behavior. And the reason is that Zen clock source, you know, is nominally 1 gigahertz, but it's only approximately that. It's actually drifting all over the place. Now, by definition, in the dependent paradigm, there is no clock sync algorithm running in the guests. Therefore, they have no way of measuring the drift of that Zen clock source counter, and therefore no way of correcting for it. Now, let's try the independent case. This is where every single guest has its own completely separate and independent NTPD running. So in particular, that means that they're all sending out packets out to the server. They're all doing that. So that's, you know, it's not very good use of resources, and I hate to think what the NIC is thinking of that. But that's the status quo under Zen right now. So similarly as before, and in the normal, not unvirtualized world, it's a similar story to then. NTPD could perform well or may not perform well, depending. But in this case, because of the extra latencies involved in virtualization, it's easier for it to tip over into that instability. So here's an example of where it is performing well. And we've thrown in a comparison with RagClock there just for the hell of it, and it's doing something similar. But again, we change parameters a bit. We add a little bit of load here, a little bit of guest churn, and we have a curve which is impossible to see, perhaps. The important point is that scale now is 5,000 microseconds, so we're again back into millisecond size errors, just by making things slightly nastier. And what about under migration? Well, we take that same clock that we saw from the previous slide, and now migrate that system to another host. Now, the problem is NTPD is stateful. It's got a bunch of parameters that are tied to the hardware of the host that it's on. So when you move it to another hardware, that state is totally inaccurate. And unfortunately, it takes a long time for it to recover. And you get what we call the migration shock, and it's very severe, and you're going to see that soon. So now, what does the RagClock do? How is it different? So here are the principles we need to focus on now. I won't be describing the algorithm itself. I have absolutely no time for that, but we have a bunch of papers that you can look at if you're interested in that. The first thing here is that timestamping, as I said before, is this raw timestamping concept of simply reading a hardware counter. So it's totally independent of the clock algorithm, totally independent of any clock parameters. It's just read the raw counter. Then there's the synchronization algorithm itself. It takes in those raw timestamps of the timing messages. It also takes the timestamps from the server. And the algorithm calculates clock parameters and makes those clock parameters available to the system. And then finally, when you want to read the clock, what you do is you, when at the appropriate moment of interest, you will read what the raw counter says. You will fetch the parameters and take your time about it if you want, and combine those together and end up with a system clock time. So you get a nice decoupling between these three aspects in the system. So the same thing, but more concretely, you may like to use HBET as a counter, so you would read HBET when you want to timestamp something. The sync algorithm is running, and it's measuring these three parameters. The period, which is a long-term measurement of the period of the counter, which enables you to convert from counter units into seconds. K, which is just an origin, correcting the origin. Instead of boot time, it will now correspond to UTC or some appropriate timescale. And finally, an estimate of the drift, that final error, the drift, which will be subtracted out. So in the clock reading operation, just underneath for the absolute clock, all we have to do is we take the counter, HBET at time T, multiply by a period to convert it to second units, add a constant to fix the origin, and then subtract out our best estimate of the error at the time. It's simple, it's decoupled. Finally, on the last line there, a very important point, though not the focus of our talk today, but I cannot resist talking about this, because I really like this. The advantage of this feed-forward paradigm where you have this, use these raw timestamps is that you can also define what we call a difference clock. It's defined right there, which you use to measure time differences on small timescales. The big benefit is you can do that incredibly, very accurately and incredibly robustly, much more robustly than you can measure absolute time. Now, in many cases, time differences are in fact what you want to use a clock for. If you're measuring round-trip times, for example, or if you're measuring code execution times, time differences are often what you really want, very often. So the ability to be able to measure those really accurately is very useful, And this is something which you inherently cannot do in a feedback-based paradigm like NDPD. For the implementation issues to make that rad clock vision work, just one thing I want to focus on, that is that you do need to get access to that counter. And you want the whole counter, not just part of it, not just a delta, you want the whole thing. So we've made appropriate kernel adjustments to create accumulative versions of counters to make them wide enough so that they won't wrap over in reasonable time, et cetera, and to make sure they're available both to user and kernel context. This is the key thing. We call that feed-forward support, and that will be actually built into FreeBSD in the relatively near future. So on Zen, hopefully it's now almost clear to you that based on what I've said already about how the rad clock architecture, that it's really a perfect match to the concept of a dependent clock in a virtualized system. So the idea is on domain zero, we contain the one and only clock of the system. It's the only one talking to the time server. It measures those clock parameters, makes them available, and we do that in Zen through the Zen store file system, which is already there. We didn't make that, but we just make those parameters available. And now each guest, all they have to do when they want to read the clock is read the appropriate counter, for example, Zen clock source, which is already available to all guests, retrieve that data, compose it together, and you've got your time. And so in this way, all guest clocks will identically have the same clock, so there's no problem in them in having them agree. There's a caveat in that you could get a problem of stale data with the Zen update being a little bit late, but this is very unlikely, and even if it occurs, the fallout is really small. Again, the support needed is similar to what I mentioned before. You have to be able to read the full counter. You have to be able to read the clock parameters. But that's not difficult to arrange. Here's an example. I gave you an example before running on domain zero, so just to give you something different, I've actually given you an example here of running in two DOMUs. That's because it's nice to show that you can have these two things running, running on different systems, and yet they agree, and also using different counters. Here, one is using Zen clock source, one is using HPET. And you're possibly wondering why you're getting this oscillating pattern there. That's actually due to the air conditioning cycle in the machine room, because these machines are actually in a machine room. So as you can see, that oscillation is actually responsible for the majority of the error there. So, now, what about migration? Well, for the same reasons I outlined before, you know, if you've got a dependent clock paradigm, you're already a large part of the way towards making migration easy. And the rest of the architecture of rad clock does the rest of the job. So as I said at the beginning, clocks don't migrate. Only this clock reading function does. So there's no problem. There's no state that's going to be totally irrelevant when you change machine. Still, there is some small issue. There's that asymmetry I mentioned before comes out here. When you move to another machine, the asymmetry will be different. There'll be different asymmetries within the host because of the machine and the operating system combination. There will be different asymmetry, and that's going to create a jump in the clock when you move from one host to the next. That is not something that any algorithm can do anything about, but it's important to be aware of that. So let me show you an example of the migration. So the setup here is two machines, both running rad clock inside domain zero. Then we'll have a guest that's going to move backwards and forwards between these machines, and we're going to look what the clock does. And we're going to look at the NTPD clock, the dependent clock that's inside the operating system, and also the dependent solution, rad clock solution that we're proposing. Here, slightly complicated figure. The two curves down the bottom that are oscillating almost together, that's just the clocks on domain zero, just to show you that what they look like and to show you that they're agreeing very closely. But please don't focus on them. The thing to focus on are the two curves higher up. Now, you'll see a number of vertical dashed vertical lines. They correspond to when a migration event happens. So we start off in a nice stable configuration, and then after the first half an hour, we migrate. After another couple of hours, we migrate again, and so on. So each time we reach a migration event, that vertical line, we see that the NTP clock goes crazy. It goes right off the scale there, and in fact, we get errors in the order of seconds. And the convergence time to recover from where it was before is of the order of hours. So that's what we call a migration shock, and it's not very pretty. In contrast, the NTP, the rad clock solution is effectively, as you can see, virtually unaffected by the migration, as you might expect. We've drawn in these horizontal lines we've drawn in to show you the effect of that asymmetry. You see, in our test bed, we are actually capable of measuring and removing those asymmetry effects, which, of course, running live normally you cannot do. But here we've measured them and we've drawn them in as those horizontal lines, just so you can get a feeling for the size of the error in this particular case. The error, of course, is going to be different depending on the specifics of the situation. Now, I'm pretty much out of time, so just very quickly, I want to give you an idea of how the noise present in the system, which the clock has to deal with, varies as a function of important parameters. So here, the first parameter is the number of guests in the operating system, and the measure of noise is what we call RTT host. So the RTT is the time it takes for the packet to go to the from the host to the server and back. RTT host is the part of that round-trip time which is actually inside the host. So it's a kind of measure of a minimal latency that that you have to put up with, that's on top of your packet timestamps. So we can see there that as you go from native on the left, which is a non-virtualized system, to Xen, you're already getting an extra 20 microseconds of penalty there, and then it gets worse as the number of guests increase. And in the second plot, you're looking from the point of view of guests, DOMU guests, you see that you're getting an extra 50 more on top of what domain zero is seeing. So these are this is noise at the magnitude of absolute, you know, this is an upper bound on the kind of noise that the clock is going to have to deal with, and it does vary. Another issue is power management. So here we have that same measure of RTT host noise, extra latency, as a function of different deeper sleep states. And as you might expect, as you go into deeper sleep states, there is a high latency you have to deal with for each of the two counters illustrated there. And my final plot, that's what's happening underneath that the system has to deal with, but when it comes to the variability of the errors that the clock is returning, here we've subtracted out the mean errors, only looking at the variability. We see that the clock is managing, despite that extra latency variability, to give pretty uniform results despite the different sleep states. So in conclusion, the feed-forward approach, which is in a large part of the core of the Radcock approach, has a number of advantages, and those advantages are particularly natural match to the needs of paravirtualization. It enables us to use dependent clock paradigm with all the advantages that flow from that, and in particular, seamless live migration of the machine. The LagCrop project is a project that aims to replace NTPD, a new timing system for the internet. We have packages and code on the web with that address there if anyone's interested in downloading it and trying it. So thank you, and I'll be happy to ask thousands of questions.
Hi. Looking at your RadClock work, a lot of what you described in this paper was about algorithms and clock reading mechanisms. You didn't say anything about the protocol for network synchronization with RadClock. I was wondering, would it work to apply the same clock reading mechanisms and clock adjustment algorithms from RadClock while using the existing NTP protocol for synchronization, thus allowing incremental deployment?
So currently we do use the NTP protocol, and we do all of the testing we've done in our papers, which involves, in fact, years of testing running live, is all with NTP servers using NTP protocol.
Thanks.
Hi, Dave Koch, Nick Doon, UNSW. So it seems that the largest benefit you're seeing is avoiding the migration shock. So, I mean, by orders of magnitude, that's, you know, six order of magnitude bigger than any other error you see. And it seems that that's being fixed mostly because you're doing a dependent clock and not an independent clock. Okay. So that being the case, how much is RadClock actually buying you over NTP? So it seems like the biggest benefit, the biggest thing you're showing, is that a dependent clock is the way to go, independent's not good. And that RadClock is useful just because it lets you do a dependent clock? And I mean, to what extent, I mean, could you make NTP do a dependent clock? Is there any fundamental reason why NTP couldn't make be modified to do a dependent clock and right. give you most of the benefit?
Yeah, so I agree with what you said. Yeah, making the dependent clock work is the key thing, certainly for the migration shock. That's the key thing. So I did show you, a solution before Zen changed to this current solution, which is the independent NTP clock solution. They use the dependent clock solution.
The dependent NTP one where it was sawtooth thing.
Right. So that obviously is only one particular, implementation, which doesn't work. But if you think about how NTP works, the problem comes down to this, the fact that you've got two heads trying to control the same thing and the statefulness of it. So with NTPD, you've got the NTPD daemon and you've also got the software clock code. Right. By definition, under dependent clock paradigm and the guests, you would not have NTPD running.
Right? Yeah, right.
So that means half of the two-headed monster is gone, and the system doesn't know how to work with half of the two-headed monster gone.
Okay, right. So you're saying there is sort of something fundamental that's going to stop you?
Yeah, it's structured to make it really hard. I mean, possibly you could twist things around, you'd have to make substantial changes, but...
Okay.
You'd have to think it... a lot of things through from scratch.
But, okay.
Antoine Bourts of University of Utah. So I really like this work and I was even trying to use it. And I was reading your papers a while ago, and we all know that all these TAC counters are highly dependent on temperature. And it wasn't clear at all how your clock behaves under the workload, because it seemed that you're running it on a cold machine, and if it's sensitive to cooling oscillations, and we know that the workload is what heats the machine and can what it really can change the temperature, probably in 30 Celsius degrees. So how do you think, do you have a comment on how stable is your clock?
Right, so the question is about the impact of temperature. So we've looked at, here everything I showed you, those machines in the machine room, but we've done measurements in other environments. Where you can clearly see diurnal variations in temperature and so on. High temperature is not a problem. It's rapid changes in temperature is what causes the problem. So rack clock does adapt to, the whole point of the algorithm is to measure and remove drift. So the drift is primarily caused by temperature. So that's the function of the clocks, in fact, to do that. So in a variety of different temperature environments, it does do that rather well.
I guess my question is still if you suddenly start a CPU intensive job, what is the stability of the clock? Is it just goes to milliseconds again or not?
Right. So the answer to how accurate is the clock, unfortunately, has to be it depends, right? Because the crucial factor is how far away the server that you're synchronizing to is, and you've also got the asymmetry of the path, and then you've also got temperature. And you've also got some load factors. Now, in our previous work, we've shown the impact of load, and it's very low sensitivity to that, and also to the distance to the NTP server. So we have results detailing those things. The very rough answer could be, if conditions aren't atrocious and on the LAN, you're getting, say, 10 microseconds, could be better. If the NTP server if conditions, again, aren't too bad, and it's 5 milliseconds away, then you might be getting 150 microseconds error. But again, the asymmetry component is a wild card.
Thank you.
Okay.
We've run a bit over time, so I'm afraid we'll have to take any additional questions offline. But let's thank our speaker.